here on Dave's Gone By. It's 11:07 in the morning on this November 17th, 2012. We're doing our 400th episode of Dave's Gone By. Time to get a little rabbinical and a little homosexual, in a manner of speaking. Our guests for this episode of the show, very special episode, include Rabbi Saul Solomon, who is the spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. Rabbi Saul recently did his one-man, two-person show, Shalom Damn It, an evening with Rabbi Saul Solomon. He developed the show right here at UNC, did it in New York a couple of times, and then he's going to be bringing it back to Weld County in January. More details to follow, but go see ShalomDammit.com to keep apprised of the rabbi's activities. But he's right here. He's in the neighborhood with us because he wanted to interview a funny, funny fellow. He is, Rabbi Saul will introduce him, but he's Frank DeCaro. You'll have seen him on dozens of TV shows as a pundit, a quipster, someone that the media turns to for a really succinct, hilarious line, be it about movies or pop culture or things in the news. Just look him up. If you don't know who I'm talking about, just Google it and you'll know immediately. Oh, that guy. Well, yeah. That guy, Frank DeCaro, is in the neighborhood with Rabbi Saul Solomon. So without further ado, let us hear them both.
This is Frank DeCaro, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio. I used to live in Fort Collins. Really?
Well, it is so wonderful to be here in the neighborhood on this Saturday Shabbos morning with a very funny and talented and eclectic man, and he's also a homosexual. We'll be talking about that. I'm not telling things out of school here. It's not like he's about to come out of the closet on this show. His name is Frank DeCaro. He's hilarious. He's written a couple of books, including this most recent one about dead celebrities and their recipes, and now he's updated it, I think, for the holidays, doing all sorts of stuff. You're seeing him on TV, on VH1, on E, all these sort of secondary networks. You will have seen Frank DeCaro, and now he's on a tertiary radio show called Dave's Gone By with me, Rabbi Saul. Welcome, Shalom, Frank DeCaro.
Rabbi, it's so nice to meet you. I feel guilty talking to you, though, because it's the book is called Christmas in Tinseltown, and there's no Hanukkah chapter. I feel bad.
If you're feeling guilty, that's Jewish. And therefore,
okay,
it already has the Hanukkah angle in it. You're all set. So tell us first about the Dead Celebrity Cookbook, and then the Goyish Christmas version of the Dead Celebrity Cookbook. What are these things?
Well, the first book that I worked on was the first cookbook I ever worked on, I should say, was the Dead Celebrity Cookbook, and it's recipes from 145 stars who've gone on to the great studio commissary in the sky. And I have been collecting celebrity recipes for years and years and years and years. In any form I could get them, with one exception. I never found things on the internet. I thought that was cheating. I had to do it the old-fashioned way by going to flea markets and garage sales and on eBay and buying everything I could get my hands on, like if it was a newspaper clipping or a magazine article or a celebrity calendar or a Beverly Hills Woman's Club annual from 1931. Whatever it was, I bought it and I amassed this huge collection, and I thought I need to do something with these celebrity recipes. And also because I wanted people to know about these stars or at least remember them in a fond way. And I thought, you know, and Jewish and I'm Italian, you're Jewish, it's pretty much the same thing. And if you give them a little snack, and they'll stay for the history lesson, you know? So I thought I would pass along some pop culture information while feeding them a great recipe or two or three or 145.
Well,
so that's what I've done. And now in the new one, it's all stuff based on Christmas, and there's also a New Year's chapter, because I figured with Dick Clark going, I thought he and Guy Lombardo needed their own chapter, so I gave them a chapter.
Now, wait a minute. What recipe did Dick Clark have? Just white bread with mayonnaise? What did he eat?
It was a spicy turkey meatloaf.
Spicy? Now, where did you find
it? It kind of is white bread with
if you think about it. But where did you find the Dick Clark recipe?
He was in any number of, I found a bunch of Dick Clark recipes, actually, maybe two or three or four, from various sources, things like out-of-print cookbooks or old biographies or whatever. And I don't remember where I found his, but in somewhere in the archives, which is drawer after drawer of materials, I found it. And I thought, you know, turkey meatloaf was good, because Guy Lombardo's thing, I thought I wrote an essay in the book, in Christmas in Tinseltown, about the difference between Guy Lombardo and you know, Dick Clark in terms of what New Year's with Guy meant and New Year's with Rockin' Eve meant, you know.
Right.
And so, like, Guy Lombardo had Lobster Lombardo. Meanwhile, Dick Clark appealed to a different demographic, and it was the spicy meatloaf demographic.
I think it's rather interesting that now we won't be able to eat spicy turkey meatloaf without thinking of Dick. I think that's quite a...
I always do, Rev.
Do you? Yeah.
Thank you. I do. Whenever I eat meat, I think of Dick. Yeah, I do.
So, and
I love him. He's America's teenager, you know, forever. And you know, New Year's is just not the same without Dick Clark.
So what are some of the most bizarre recipes that you came across in compiling these two books?
First, I'll tell you the best one.
Okay.
The best, the tastiest, my favorite one in any of the books is Katharine Hepburn's brownies, and it's the most famous dead celebrity recipe ever because...
How much cannabis is in them?
Whenever anyone says there's a dead celebrity recipe, they said, oh, you mean like Katharine Hepburn's brownies? For some reason, the old broad was known for her brownies, and I've made them so many times now, and they are about the best brownies you ever would want to eat.
What's in them that makes them so... is it because she wouldn't actually mix the recipe? She just had to stand there and she would shake and it would all come together in a brownie?
Well, that's why I always say, are your brownies no great shakes? Try Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, that's funny.
That's my slogan. So thank you for going there.
Sorry.
I felt that hers are the best because they're kind of no-nonsense the way she is. You know, they're just a few simple ingredients thrown together, but pure, tasty, fresh ingredients. And you know, a little chocolate, a couple of nuts, an egg, you know, and you're there. So it's great. The creepiest one, well, there are two.
Oh, okay, good.
One's in the new book and one's in the old book. The old book, the original book, I should say, the old book sounds terrible. The original Dead Celebrity Cookbook has a recipe for Wheezy's Boston Chicken, and it's Isabel Sanford who played Louise Jefferson on the Jefferson.
Of course! Oh, my goodness, they're moving on. Oh, no, wait, that's the deluxe apartment. That's the wrong, what was their theme song?
Yeah, they moved on up to the deluxe apartment in the sky. Well, her recipe was still somewhere in Queens. You know, it was the chicken dish that she made, you mix Russian dressing and apricot jam.
Oh.
And a packet of onion soup mix, and then you painted it on the chicken. It's pretty gross.
Wouldn't it be funny if she died?
That came with a disclaimer in the first book.
Well, wouldn't it be funny if she died of diabetes? Paula Deen, you know?
Oh, I don't know. It's never funny. Well, no, sometimes it is funny.
Sometimes it's funny.
Anyway, but in the new book, excuse me, the new book has a chapter on the Star Wars Holiday Special, which was probably the worst 2 hours of television that have ever been on. But in a brilliant kind of way. And they had... The weird thing wasn't so much that the original cast of... You know, the Star Wars people are you know, are in it. Carrie Fisher is in it. Han Solo, you know, it's
right.
Really there. The weirder thing is that so is Dorothy's Bornak from The Golden Girls. Beatrice Arthur is there.
Oh, I love Bea! Yes?
Yeah, I love her too. But she has a recipe in you put sort of a jellied consommé in halves of avocados, and it's I was a little creeped out by that, but I thought, well, we'll put it in there, because I didn't want to repeat any recipes from the first book, and I had the other B. Arthur recipe that I had my hands on, we already used that, so I thought, well, I'll go with this other one, but it's you sort of used jellied consommé, you know, does that sound gross? You used to be able to buy, like, cans, but you still can, you know, your can of consommé, but you kind of add a few other ingredients and then chill it, and then you sort of flake it so it's almost jello inside your... I'm scared.
Oh, my God. Well, as I always like to say, if you can't be good, be Arthur. That's what I like to always tell.
Exactly. I'm with you. I think that's good advice to live by. It really is.
Advice to live by the way, from Frank DeCaro. We're talking to this author. He is also a radio host. You're on Sirius. Is it, this confuses me also. Is it Sirius XM? Just Sirius? Is it, what the hell do they call it, and when are you on?
I'm SiriusXM, and I'm on from 11, Eastern Time is 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and it's 8 to 11 Pacific, and in the middle you have to do your own math, but it's 8 to 11 Pacific, and every weekday, and they're it's a naughty little talk show, and I do have satellite radio mouth. I say stuff that's pretty awful, but in a loving kind of way.
Oh, of course.
And those crazed people who do listen to it are obsessed, and sometimes the show... My favorite show ever was we had Tom Ford, who was one of the most chic designers and filmmakers ever. You know, I mean, around, he was the guy who did the Gucci line, and also Ernest Borgnine, God rest his soul, on the same program. And I thought, that's pretty good. You got like this 93-year-old dirty old man and the chicest designer ever, and all within the space of 3 hours. I was pretty impressed with that.
That is exciting. And, sorry, continue.
Justin Bieber boy was on. Justin Bieber came to see us. That was boring. And Bea Arthur, I was talking about before, when she was alive, she came to see us. So some of them are young, some of them are old, some of them are dead. But they actually brought, a man brought Rue McClanahan's ashes with him.
No.
Secretary of her estate, he brought Rue McClanahan posthumously to my show, which was a thrill, because she'd been on Alive. It was even better. You know, she was even a good interview dead. So it was exciting.
She's no longer a golden girl. She's a carbon girl.
That's true, yes. True. She's golden to me. So,
she
was something, but we've had lots of really amazing people on.
So who is the worst guest you've ever had on your radio show?
Alan Arkin.
Alan, well, he seems like a creepy, weird calorie. What was wrong with him?
Wonderful interviewer, but a pain in the tuchus. I know a few words. He was just.
Well, you're gay. You like a pain in the tuchus now.
And
I'm sorry.
He didn't want to push his book. He said, I don't want to talk about my book. I said, but you're booked on a book tour. Your publicist is from the publisher. They were supposed to talk about the book. You want to buy it? Buy it. You don't want to buy it? Don't buy it. And I was like, thanks for nothing. He was not very nice.
Oh, that's funny, because I would figure that would be a wonderful opening for you. Because we're all obligated. You go on Letterman, you go on whatever, and you've got to push, and they have to spend half the time showing the clip from the shitty movie that they're in or whatever. If this person is saying, you know what, let's not talk about my book, let's talk about my life, something else. I think that's...
He wants to talk about his life. I said, well, what about this movie? Oh, it was a long time ago. What about that? He just was a crabby old man, you know? And it's like, and I'm only 50 and I'm crabby, but not compared to him. I'm lovely. I'm a walk in the park compared to him. I'm sweet and lovely.
Oh, totally. You know,
he was really annoying. I don't like that. I mean, I don't want him to be too hard sell, you know, but I kind of want him to have, you know, it's just like, don't sit there and antagonize the host. It's like, I'm trying to make him look good. He should try and be nice to me, you know? So.
And what about...
Call Mike Wallace on him or anything.
What about idols that either you had on your show or that you've met? People that you never thought you'd even get within 200 yards of, and suddenly you've got a microphone in their face.
I just was talking to Bette Midler about a week or two ago. That was really exciting. On Halloween, actually, I was talking to Bette Midler, and she was always someone I admired growing up. I sat down with Elton John. That was astounding for me. I've always... he was the man I wanted to grow up to be, I am a fat bald guy, so apparently I've become him. So there's that. I mean, I don't have fake hair, but if I did, I'd want it to be
like Elton,
a strange color, just like his. Yeah, I would.
Now, you speak of growing up. I have to think that where you grew up and how you grew up was, might have been a little difficult for you, considering that you're who you are and the way you are. Was it difficult, or am I overstating the case?
Was it because I was fat and bald, or because I'm homosexual?
Pick one.
And
pick
heard,
three.
Hello. And then I thought you were upset because I used the word homosexual.
Oh, no, I wouldn't get upset by that. What was easier than I would expect about your growing up, and what was what everybody would expect about your growing up?
Well, the fact that I think the thing that turned out to be a benefit that I didn't know was that I was a little bit weird, you know? Because I was a little... Still am. I mean, I've written cookbooks called The Dead Celebrity Cookbook. You know, I mean, it's a little wacky to begin with. So it doesn't help you as a kid to be the weirdo, but as an adult, it kind of does, because you sort of look at stuff a little different and people like that. But the other part was that I was, you know, I was not only the chubby kid, I was the chubby straight-A student who also was very flamboyant. So it was a kind of a, I pick on me now is basically the bottom line, you know? It's like, I would definitely pick on me. But, you know, I was the kid that they would say, well, whoever gets the top score on the test, that will be whatever the A is, and then we'll work from there. You know, they'd grade it on the curve. And then I would get, like, a 99, and then the next person would get a 74, you know, and then everyone would get screwed. So I would hate me, too, you know, but I was a really good student, and I was a big, you know, the teachers loved me, and the students hated me. And
did you go immediately into theater?
No, I was a journalist. I went to journalism school, and I wrote for a little newspaper called the New York Times.
And
many others, and I've written for tons of magazines, and that's how my career started. And then I got on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, but it was before Jon Stewart, it was Craig Kilborn, and I was on there for 6.5 years, and the kind of attention you get for being on television is so much more fun than the attention you get for writing for a newspaper, and I thought, this is great. So I decided, the big ham in me, sorry about the word ham, but I decided to be a performer. And so I had a sort of a reinvention. And so I'm a writer-performer now is what my official title is.
Well, let's roll that back a little bit. You're writing for the New York Times, which is a pretty wonderful launching point. So how did the Jon Stewart gig, that was the real stepping stone there, how did that come about? Did you audition? Did they ask you? What happened?
I was writing for the magazine, the now dearly departed magazine, called Spy Magazine. It was a humor magazine, very barbed, very naughty.
I remember, yes. It was the pre-TMZ.
I was writing for that, and the guy who hired me to write there was canned before his first issue even hit the newsstand. And I had more fun with him putting that page, those few pages that I did for him together. And I thought, well, that was the most fun I ever had for a minute, you know, and that'll be, I'll never hear from him again, and that was great. And he called and he said, I started working on this show. It's only been on a few weeks. Called The Daily Show, and Craig Kilborn hosted. I don't know if you know him, and, you know, I don't know. And he said, why don't you come on and talk about movies and talk about your first book? I had done a memoir in 1996 called A Boy Named Phyllis about growing up gay. So I went on, and I pushed my book, and I talked about movies, and it went very well. And then they said, come back and talk about movies. And one thing led to another, and suddenly I'm on The Daily Show. But, of course, no one is watching it. And then little by little, I'm like, oh my God, I've been here forever, and now Jon Stewart's the host, and suddenly this was my 100th review, and that kind of thing. And so I was their movie critic for all those years, for 6.5 years, and just through dumb luck, it was by being, you know, the right place at the right time, and being at something when no one knew it was going to be a big deal. However, I may have been the person holding them back, because they didn't win Emmys when I was there, and now they can't not win. You know, I mean, they have too many Emmys now. It's almost upsetting.
But here's
maybe when they let me go, it was the right decision. You know, I mean, they're everyone loves them.
Now here's
holding them back, apparently.
Well, let me ask you about this. So you got this gig. You've done 100, more than 100 reviews. The show is getting more and more popular. You're getting face recognition and value and stuff. And then, as you said, they let you go. How do you, I mean, after all that time, did you have a moment of like, oh my God, what am I going to do now? How could they let me go? Did you feel angry? Did you go through the 7 stages of show business withdrawal? What happened?
I went through the 70 pounds of show business withdrawal, I think. No, I was, you know, I'm a nervous eater, and I spent a year just shoving my face and being miserable and stuff. And then this radio show came along, and I had been subbing, you know, I was unemployed for a few months, and so they were like, come and sub and do this radio show, and so I was doing, filling in, guest hosting here and there, and they liked me, and then one day they called me on, like, a Wednesday or Thursday, and they said, I think we need you to do a show, and I said, well, I said, what, and they said, starting Monday, and I was like, what, and I said, it's Thursday at 9 o'clock at night, what are you doing, and they said, well, come in tomorrow, we'll have a meeting, and you go on the air on Monday, and so that's how it happened, and suddenly there in 2004, there I was, and now here we are, 8 years later, and I've been on the radio every day.
Do you love it? Is radio wonderful? Do you enjoy doing it still?
Oh, you can be fat on the radio, that's nice, you know, that's a good thing. I miss doing a regular television. I miss having a regular television presence because you don't quite. It's not the ego stroking that TV was. You know, TV was. I'm one of those people that, like, when I cross the street and someone goes, "Hey, Frank," I love it. You know, I like when strangers accost me. And so I
keep that in mind, listeners. Yes, okay.
Yeah, so anyway, so listeners do that, but I live in Manhattan, and it's not really a radio town, you know, in terms of people aren't driving their cars, so
right.
None of my friends have Sirius radios. No one knows what I'm up to, you know, so you don't get quite the, oh my God, I saw you last night on TV. So as a complete egotist, radio is not as much fun. As in terms of the crazy people and wonderful people I've gotten to meet and the awful things I've gotten to say, it's been great, you know, and it continues to be great. So it's different, you know. And in radio, as you know, Rabbi, you know, in radio is a lot of you have to book the guests and you have to do a lot. You're doing a lot more work than if you're on a TV show where you kind of show up and they say you're being made up in 15 minutes, Mr. DeCaro, and, you know, here's the craft services table, have a snack, you know. In radio, it's basically book the guest, escort them from the lobby, sit them down, do the interview, show them how to offer them a water. You know, I mean, you're doing everything, pretty much. And so it's not quite as glamorous.
Although I will say, and I probably shouldn't admit this, sometimes on the radio, I take off my yarmulke. Sometimes. Not always. Just I get lazy.
Sometimes. Look, you have to do that once in a while. Do you know, want to hear a terrible, like, Goyish confession? I have been, you know, I have no hair, you know, so if I'm going to a nice event, I go the day before and I get it all buzzed, so it's almost Daddy Warbucks, you know. It's not shaved, but almost, you know.
Right.
And sometimes, if you'll be at something, your the yami won't stay on. So I bring a Band-Aid with me, and I roll it, and I stick it, you know? And I'm sure there are other things, but the only thing I ever thought of was a Band-Aid. So I used a roly Band-Aid and stuck my head so it would stay on my head.
Probably there's that wall tack you can use.
That would be good. I didn't have that at the time. I had my roly Band-Aid. That was really, yeah. But I have done that and stuff. But I've always been very respectful, except for the time I put a yarmulke on my dog because he looked cute, and he was very cute. Because so, we had his bar mitzvah, and so I put a yarmulke on him, and he looked very cute.
Yeah, but he chewed the hell out of the tallis, so it was.
It could be, but the only thing that was bad was my friends were like my husband, I should say, said to me, my friends cannot see that their wedding yarmulke is on the dog, and I was like, I'm sorry, I didn't know, you know.
No, wait, hold on. You did mention, and everybody should know, your husband, and you had something like a Tiny Tim media kind of wedding, did you not?
I did. Liz Winstead, who I used to do the movie reviews with, who created The Daily Show, married me on Sirius XM Satellite Radio on my 15th anniversary with my now husband. We've been together since 1996, and so we got married a year ago August. And it was the moment they said that the gays could marry, I was like, let's do it before they take it back. And so we got married. And the best part was registering. I don't mean to be so shallow, but I have gorgeous china now, Rabbi. I have beautiful things, you know.
You get tchotchkes. Well, gay men always have tchotchkes, but yes, now you get other people to give them to you. Yes, this is. So tell me, how's marriage? Is it, you know, I mean, you were with this other person for 15 years. Is marriage just as miserable as it is for the rest of us, or what?
It is. It's the same as it is for everyone. You know, it's just, if people find gay sex offensive, they should just let us all get married because you stop doing it. You just, once in a while in a hotel, you think, well, we could. And you do, you know. But most of the time, it's a lot of, did you finish the dishes? It's like, why can't you do anything around here? You're making a pile of stuff where there didn't used to be. It's a lot of that, you know, and very little ooh baby, you know. It's a lot of
will there be off.
I can't watch the Real Housewives of New Jersey one more minute, you know. That kind of, it's more that than it is you know, penthouse form or, you know, or playgirl form or whatever dirty thing you want to call it.
Well, now speaking of ooh baby, do you see a baby in your guys?
Oh my God, no. I'm a 300-pound baby. That's all the baby we need.
Well, that's fair.
So, I'm an adorable butterball, and I'm built like a toddler, and I'm the only one we're ever going to have. But I do have a new dog, because Herman, who wore the yarmulke, God rest his soul, Herman went to meet his maker at age 15. But then this past January, Gabby entered our life, and she's a crazy girl, and so I have a new doggy.
Mit Mazel, mit dog, that's wonderful. I'm so happy that you have the dog with it. But I do have to say this, now, and you say these things yourself. You are overweight, you're bald, you're gay, you're a pasty white man, and on top of all this, You're colorblind.
I know, and I was a fashion editor. It's not a best quality for a fashion editor to be, you know, to be built like a yellow M&M and not be able to know whether you're yellow or not. Is that not the best quality for a fashion editor? Yeah, that's what I did for like 12 years, too. And I was good at it, too, for someone who...
Now, how do you be a fashion designer and not be able to see color?
No, I wasn't a designer. I was a fashion editor. It's different. I was, you know, I was writing about it and going to all the collections. I know, it was a little deranged. Maybe some of the things I said were lime green, may have been canary yellow. I don't know.
Good. It's like a symphony.
Who knows now? You know, but I did. I had a good sense of humor about all of it, and I wrote it.
It's like a symphony orchestra.
I wrote about everything, except I would never tell people. First, I wouldn't tell people I was from New Jersey, and then when I came out about that.
Oh, God.
Yeah,
no.
My big secret was that I was colorblind and a fashion editor. So that was kind of weird. But that was 100 pounds ago. Now, you never would know it now. I just look like a fanboy. You know, I'm fat and I scratch and I watch TV and, you know.
Thanks for the image. But speaking of a fanboy, also on your wiki, because we have to check the wiki for these things.
Checked my wiki. Oh, Rabbi.
I haven't looked at your Wii or your PlayStation, but I did see your wiki, and it mentions that you have this enormous Batman collection.
I do.
What is it with Batman?
Enormous things I have are my waist and this Batman collection. But, yeah, I've been collecting Batman things. I have been known to wrestle a small child to the ground for a toy that's, you know,
Hopefully that's the only reason you're wrestling a child to the ground. Okay, yes.
It's not anything, it's not dirty. It's just give me that damn toy, you little brat. And, you know, so, no, I do, and I brought a bunch of, someone at Warner Brothers sent me the, like, 8-foot-tall cardboard stand-up Dark Knight Rises, you know, lobby display. It's as big as a refrigerator. It's ridiculous. And we can't figure out how to get it to the house in New Jersey from the apartment in New York because we don't have a car big enough, you know? I mean, it's a ridiculously large...
Well, it's Batman. It can fly, can't it? No, I'm kidding.
You would think. Right? I would put it on the top of the car, but I worry about, you know, the airborne, you know. Well, no, with me in the car, it wouldn't go. I'm just scared it'll fly off and some rotten little kid will get it. But no, I have tons and tons of Batman toys, and I am a collector. Well, and the collecting is what fed into this whole obsession with dead celebrity recipes. It became, you know, you have to do something with your collections, or the people, you know, the casting director for Hoarders comes to your house, and then they take away everything. And that Hoarders program upsets me because there was like this, a couple of years ago, there was a lady with all these Beanie Babies and no teeth, and now she has no teeth and no Beanie Babies. It's like, so that kind of breaks my heart. At least she had, you know, if you're going to be toothless, you might have a collection of Beanie Babies, you know.
Something, yeah.
For the fact you have to gum your soup, you know.
I guess, how did we get on? I don't even know.
No, I just, it's about collecting. Anyway, well, once you collect anything, you sort of, it kind of becomes your whole way of consuming the world.
But was Batman this important, heroical character to you when you were a child?
I thought Dark Knight Rises was amazing. But no, I've always loved it ever since the TV show in the 60s, which was my first introduction to Batman and Robin. Well, I like him. As a gay guy, I like that he has a double life. You know, I like, don't find out about Batman. You know, he's not who you think he is. You know, I thought of stuff that was interesting. But it's just, I don't know, it was always colorful and wonderful. And I like that he's kind of, I like that he's rich, but he also has, you know, this feeling of giving back and wanting to be the Dark Knight and stuff. And he's a little nutty. But the only thing is, I've always wanted to be a Batman villain. I've never wanted to be Batman.
Well, you could, yeah, I could see the thing. But let me ask you, was there ever a point in your life, speaking of double lives or things like that, when you considered going into the closet, or you had to make believe that you weren't what you were? Or you were always just flamboyant, even if you're going up for a job or a day job or anything like that? Just curious.
Well, I did. I do remember... back in the day when an employer could get away with such things, maybe in some places they still can. I had a woman ask me when I got my first fashion writing job. She said, "Well, how do you feel about the faggot factor of the job?" And I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, everyone's going to think you're gay if you're doing this." And I was like, "Well, I've never done traditional boy things, so I don't think this will be a problem." And I just left it at that at the time. But then once I started, you know, my column, I came out in the newspaper officially in 1993. So that's been a really long time now, you know. But I started writing what was the first openly gay humor column in a major daily newspaper way back then.
So that was before Savage.
Oh, that was,
yeah.
Was grooming. So I did that at the New York Newsday was the newspaper, and so I did a column, and that led to my first book, and it's kind of, you know, I'm, in some ways I'm a professional homosexual, but now it's, you know, I'm me. The brand is Frank. I sell crazy things. I hope people are as interested in these celebrities who've gone on to meet their maker. I hope that they're as interested in a little bit of pop culture history as I am. And so that's why I put these books out there. And,
well, I can't imagine...
little labors of love, you know?
I can't imagine them not being interested in everything that you're doing, being it the radio
show... But some people don't agree.
All right, I don't care about them. I care about my congregation.
That's it, yeah.
So everybody, first of all, you can find out what Frank DeCaro is doing on frankdecaro.com, DeCaro, frankdecaro.com. He's got his show on Sirius XM every single day in the mornings. You got to check the times on that. And, of course, the Dead Celebrity Cookbook and the Dead Celebrity Christmas Cookbook?
No, it's the Dead Celebrity Cookbook Presents. Christmas in Tinseltown. So that's it. But I have to say, go to deadcelebritycookbook.com because frankdecaro.com has cobwebs and there's just and termites. It's just you know when you leave your website for dead, the poor thing is kind of, I feel bad, but it's deadcelebritycookbook.com because frankdecaro.com is a little decrepit, right?
So it needs a little bit of an update, a sprucing up, a wig, if you will.
It needs more than a wig. It needs Botox. It needs many things right now. It's more, I think there's like, you know, Happy New Year 2008 on it or something. You know, it's just ridiculous. It's a little, you know, with Facebook, it's just, I have a Facebook fan page. So that's a great way to do it. So does the book. So people can also find me there. And now, Rabbi, are you as big on Facebook? Do you love Facebook as well? It's fun, isn't it?
I'm more into, like, Elbow Book. That's kind of... Facebook is too popular, but Elbow Book is cute. I like that one. You might like Tush Book, all things considered. Yeah.
Do you know the name for it? I just learned this. You know the flap of skin on your elbow? You know what that's called?
Dewlap?
Venus.
No. A what? A what?
A weenus.
A weenus? Why?
Weenus is your elbow skin. Isn't that the weird thing? So I thought, it's like when people say pupik. Doesn't that sound dirty?
Well, pupik.
You know, and it's not. It's just your tummy, right? Your pupik is your tummy.
Well, I'll tell you this. You just gave a bunch of lyricists a whole big stanza for a song right there. You know.
I know.
If you figure that there's a weenus.
But I call it weenus book. I'll do that. That's
well, as long as you don't have weenus envy. Anywho. We've been chatting.
I won't.
with the delightful Frank DeCaro. Last question for Frank DeCaro. Yes. Do you have a favorite quip that you made at one point over the years? Something that you thought, oh, I really nailed it. That was so funny over the years. Like a great one-liner of yours.
This is my quote, but what I live by was, if you really want it, get it. That's the way I feel. But there's something I've actually put out there it's okay to date bisexuals, but know that they can leave you for twice as many people. So that's pretty much, if I'm going to say anything, I would go with that.
I would go with that, too.
Because I always worried about that. Because I always assumed anyone in their right mind would leave me. So apparently my husband is not in his right mind because he continues to stay for the abuse. And I don't understand it, but he does. And he's lovely and whip smart and talented and he likes me, and I don't understand it.
I have no clue. I don't see it either. But
I wouldn't stay with me. I would buy my book, but I wouldn't go for. I wouldn't be going on 16 years with me. Let's say that.
Well, hopefully you'll be going on 16 and 20 and hundreds of years on the radio and more books to come. Frank DeCaro, you've been hilarious and delightful as we expected. Thank you for being with us in the neighborhood.
Oh, thanks, Rabbi.